Last year, Newsweek listed, quote, the most useless college majors. Among the top 10, philosophy, religion, fine arts, English, political science, and history. In other words, the liberal arts. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, Joseph Epstein, Andrew Ferguson, and what happened to the liberal arts. For the Wall Street Journal, this is Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. By the way, be sure to take a look at our website, hoover.org/UK, or look at us on Facebook at facebook.com/unkknowledge, facebook.com/unkknowledge. For some three decades, an English professor at Northwestern University and the author of more than two dozen books, Joseph Epstein writes frequently for Commentary, The New Criterion, The Weekly Standard, and The Wall Street Journal. Joseph Epstein's latest book, Essays in Biography. All you need to do to get a feeling for the way people within the literary community view Joseph Epstein is to open the cover flap. Who is the greatest living essayist writing in English? Unquestionably, it is Joseph Epstein. A former speechwriter...
Well put, John.
A former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, Andrew Ferguson is a senior editor of the Weekly Standard, writes a regular column for Commentary, and contributes frequently to Time and the Wall Street Journal. Andrew Ferguson is the author of three books, including most recently, Crazy You, One Dad's Crash Course on Getting His Kid into College. Joe and Andy, welcome to Uncommon Knowledge.
Pleasure to be here.
Segment one, what's the big deal? Joseph Epstein in his Weekly Standard essay, Who Killed the Liberal Arts? Quote, in a loose definition, the liberal arts denote college study anchored in preponderantly Western literature, philosophy, and history, with science, mathematics, and foreign languages playing a substantial, though less central, role. Close quote. Where did the liberal arts come from? And what was the point? What was the idea?
Well, I think they came from Greece for the most part, then picked up by Rome. And then picked up in early Christianity. I hope I'm doing this quick survey in an accurate way. And then probably they next divided between Oxford-Cambridge, Oxbridge kind of liberal arts. And then things changed slightly in German education, where research was the center of a good deal of education.
But the
and then, of course, when they were transported to America, the religious element came in more strongly with Protestantism. Most of the great Harvard, Yale were Protestant institutions. The institution at which I taught, Northwestern, is a Methodist institution, though there's nothing Methodistic about it that I could make out in the 30 years I was walking around there. But that's their origin. I think it's centered in ancient Greece.
So when a raw 18-year-old turns up at the campus of Northwestern or the University of Virginia or Dartmouth College and signs up as a liberal arts student, that kid is dipping his toe into an ancient stream of thought and learning and belief about what is important in life.
Absolutely.
Fair enough?
Absolutely. Right. You know, I have to tell you, I went and was not at all a good student at the University of Chicago, which in a way was a kind of Mecca, Vatican City, St. Petersburg of the liberal arts. And I was such a student.
Give us the decade. You were there
in the middle 50s.
Right.
And it was all a complete mystery. The idea of how to pronounce the name Thucydides, if you had asked me just to pronounce Thucydides at an 18-year-old boy, I would have said something like Thucydides. I had no notion of it. But somehow I understood, and this is, again, speaking as someone who was not a stellar, sparkling student, that this is big stuff and important stuff.
Joe, let me quote you once again. I'll come to you, Andy. Fear not. Believe me, I'll come to you. If I had not studied liberal arts at the University of Chicago, I suspect I would be wealthier. I might have been happier. Yet I would not trade in those years for anything. Why?
Because it gave me some notion of the standard in life and what one can reach and what one should attempt to reach and always fall short of. But it's the great game, I think.
You can say without mawkishness, without ingenuousness of any kind, that you were a better man because you read the liberal arts at Chicago half a century ago.
No, I would never say that.
You would not?
No, because I would never impute virtue to myself.
Oh.
And I wouldn't say. I would say that I think it's made life much more interesting for me. But
right.
I would not say, you know, one of the sadnesses of culture, Peter, as you know, and as Andy knows, I'm sure, is that the people who have enormous cultural attainments and are ridiculous, creepy, awful people in spite of it. That's a problem that I don't have a quick solution to.
All right. Andy, we've discussed Joe's years at the University of Chicago. You write of your years at Occidental College, quote, "I explored the great city of Los Angeles, joined a rock and roll band, became a regular at a Zen temple, attended concerts without number, swooned through doomed romances, and pursued a dozen other forms of fun," close quote. And yet you are here today to rise in defense of the liberal arts.
In defense of the things I had nothing to do with, yes. Well, I'm actually sort of the same position as Joe. I wasn't a stellar student. In fact, for this book, I went back and the people at Occidental College were nice enough to fish out my old college transcript, which was sort of reliving a nightmare. I saw this sort of monument to mediocrity, page after page of them. But I look back and there were, and I think everyone who's been through this liberal arts education has the same thing. There's one or two people who were thrilling. And there's just
professors.
No, yes, professors. There's really no other way to put it. It was something, and it was a hint at something. It wasn't, they weren't presenting me with a package of anything. They were sort of opening up a way to live your life so that you would constantly be surprised and enriched and trying to learn new things about new things. And so it wasn't an end in itself, you know. I mean, the degree, they should probably take it back. But
okay. So, but what I want, what we can establish then is that despite this screwing around and the monument to mediocrity that you compiled on your, I don't believe this entirely because
I'll
you
send it to are, you.
But you have no regret at having been a liberal arts student.
Oh,
you don't wish
no,
you'd
no,
been
no.
a business major or no. All right. Now, Joe, one more quotation from you. "For many years, the liberal arts were my second religion. Mm-hmm. Yet defending the liberal arts and the condition in which they now linger on scarcely seems worth the struggle." Explain.
Because they've been altered and changed. So the very basis of them as Western values have been undermined by most of the people who are now teaching them.
All right.
And who have been, you know, swayed and taken up by multiculturalism, feminism, the politicization of them.
Right.
Has destroyed them from within, I think.
Which brings us to segment two, the decade when everything went wrong. The 70s. Two quotations. Joseph Epstein. "The 70s was the age of deconstruction, academic feminism, historicism, Marxism, early queer theory, and other lunacies." Andrew Ferguson. "In the 1970s, the revolution of a decade before was ratified as everyday life. Core curriculums were jettisoned. The general shape that schools assumed in the 1970s stubbornly remains." Close quote. What went wrong in the 70s and why did it happen then?
Well, I think I've thought a lot about that. Why do things happen at certain times? I think it was a long, the culmination of a long series of intellectual developments. My particular bête noire right now is the social sciences, which there's sort of an internal dynamic that makes the sciences imperialistic and they keep sort of covering more and more areas of life. And as they became validated, the biological and physical sciences gave way to the social sciences. And the social sciences started to do the things that the humanities had done, or pretend to do the things that the humanities had done, which is, why do we do the things that we do? What constitutes happiness? What is meaning in life? And so on. But because it's a science, it doesn't really point to any answers for those things because it's essentially materialistic. So you start to think, well, those questions don't really mean anything at all, you know, because if science can't answer them, then they're probably not real questions. And once you start to say that, the whole edifice of the humanities collapses.
And meanwhile, I would add to what Andy said, is the humanities themselves started to ape the sciences.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that's where the money was. They would look around and see these magnificent grants being given by foundations, by the government to sciences. So they tried to scientize themselves. So you might count the number of times in Homer a certain verb arises,
yes,
and, you know, empty, arid exercise.
We have this new discipline now called the digital humanities.
Yes, exactly.
So,
but I think it's the loss of confidence that these are the great writers, that there is no Plato, no one like Plato, no one like Tolstoy, no one.
I haven't obviously thought about this the way the two of you have, but it has occurred to me that in the sciences, you get this thrill of new information or new discoveries. Research implies cutting edge, to use that horrible phrase, but breakthroughs and so forth. And in the humanities, you've got, it really should be the Matthew Arnold formulation, the best that has been thought and said. So what you're doing is not, in a certain sense, you're precisely not seeking new information. Mm-hmm. You are insisting that you must understand the patrimony of the culture. You must understand what has come before. So I'm not here to tell you anything new about Shakespeare, says, in my theory, a good English professor. I'm here to make sure you understand that Hamlet is valuable in itself. I'm here to make sure you understand what your grandparents understood. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I also think something else is going on, and that is the sciences are very tidy. When I taught, I always felt how pleasing it would be to have a specific problem and then answer it. And the answer would be numerical, whereas there were no answers to the things I taught, none whatsoever. They're just question after question opening out into question and question, and it's called a life of learning.
I disagree partly with the way you frame that, because I don't. It makes it sound as though the humanities, we'll just say, reading Aristotle's Politics or something, is plowed over ground, and what we've just got to learn is what are Aristotle's categories, and just which everybody has known for since he was, 1,500 years since he was rediscovered, and so on. But what the humanities promises is you can take this information that is old information that every great mind has absorbed, and you make it your own. What's new about the humanities and why the humanities could constantly refresh itself is because human beings are new. Someone will do something with Aristotle that's never been done before. So the illusion that it's all, you're opening up an old closet full of camphor fumes and things is not right, because they're humanities because they're about human beings, and human beings are always fresh.
Segment four. Once again, what's the big deal? Joseph Epstein. Some 18 million people in the United States are now enrolled in one kind or another of undergraduate education, but fewer than 100,000 are enrolled in liberal arts colleges. At the same time, for that small number of elite liberal arts colleges, applications continue to rise. Well, now, wait a moment. This is a very arresting datum. Only 100,000 students out of 18 million are enrolled in liberal arts institutions. So for the two of you to be so concerned about liberal arts, you understand what this makes you? Elitists.
Fuddy-duddies, I think, is the technical term.
Yes.
Defend yourself.
I have no problem with being an elitist because I don't come out of an elitist background. And I think of elitism as opposed to snobbery is just a craving for what one thinks the best. And I can live with that very easily. I don't find that at all troubling to be called an elitist. As long as the club is open to everyone.
Right. I think innovations in America has been the idea of a democratic elite. That is, that there are gradations of sophistication about things and talents and skills, but it is open to everyone. It is something that isn't class-bound. It isn't hereditary. And this is one of the wonderful things about the 50s, and the liberal arts actually contributed quite a bit to it. They called it the middle brow at the time. But the idea was you will be thrilled to learn about a Beethoven sonata. And it doesn't matter your parentage or where you live or anything. This is something to which people of all kinds have access and should have access. And so that's a kind of elitism, but it's also a sort of a populist.
Does this proportion sound right to you, 100,000 out of 18 million? That is to say, does it strike you as correct on the face of it that the liberal arts really is for only a very small proportion of students?
Well, there's a sense that only a small proportion can either afford it or have the sang-froid not to be worried about getting a job. Mm.
But if we could make you philosopher
culture, commissar of culture will do.
Commissar
thank
of
you.
Culture, let's call it the K. You'd have all 18 million instructed at least in some rudimentary aspect of the liberal
arts. I would like it, yes. I'm enough of a Democrat that I'd like everyone to have a kind of shot at this is what's going
on. Okay, Andy, let me repeat a piece of that quotation from Joe. For that small number of elite liberal arts colleges, applications continue to rise. Close quote. But if the liberal arts are in such disarray, what is going on? Why isn't the market punishing these institutions instead of rewarding them?
Well, this is to add on to your point about the utilitarianism of it. It's not simply a utilitarian good, a college education. It's also a status good, which makes it impervious to certain kinds of market pressures. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to have a degree from Harvard is going to have its own value in the marketplace as long as people think Harvard is a great place to go.
By the way, sitting right there about 3 months ago, Thomas Sowell said, and if this isn't a quotation, it's a pretty close paraphrase, the principal value of holding a Harvard degree is never again having to be impressed by a Harvard degree.
Yes, that's good. You know, I would like to just take it a step further. I wrote somewhere that some of the worst people in the country are graduates of Harvard and Yale Law School. Names on request, I said.
Names on request.
I'll just start with Elliot Spitzer, and we'll go from there. But why should this be? Why should some of the worst people in the country have gone to Yale and Harvard Law School? And I think the reason is that they are driven by a kind of empty ambition that the culture has put on, so that one goes through college not really interested in education, but in getting into Harvard and Yale, which is a very different thing. Which a digression, as if everything I haven't said up till now hasn't been a digression. But I mentioned to you earlier before the show began, I had a cousin named Sherwin Rosen who was the chairman of the Department of Economics in Chicago.
I knew him. I didn't know that you were cousins.
Yes, no, he used to come out here to Hoover.
Yes, yes.
At Sherwin's memorial service, Gary Becker got up and he said, you know, when Sherwin was a graduate student, we almost washed him out two or three times. And the reason we did his performance in seminars was so poor, you'd ask him a question and his answer would be halting, faltering. It just wasn't there. But not infrequently, he would come to you 2 days later and say, you know, the question you asked me on Tuesday, I don't think it was properly formulated. You know, you left out marginal utility of value or some economic. And Gary Becker said, you know, the lesson I drew from this is that real learning isn't about quick response, but almost all education is, and it's a deep flaw. You know, I say to Peter, 8 reasons for the Renaissance. Come on, 8 reasons. You know, Andy, he only had 4 reasons for the Renaissance. What a dope, you know.
He's sort of like being on a talk show.
Exactly. But, you know, you think about it, any kind of serious intellectual work is about brooding, going the wrong way, catching up, whereas most education is 8 reasons for the Renaissance.
What is to be done? The generational solution. As the faculties that came of age during the 60s and 70s retire, matters on campus will right themselves of their own accord. It was the madness, the lunacy, to use your term, of the 70s that became tenured and will, thank God, die off.
Well, this
So stop wringing your hands, wait a decade.
Yeah. Well, the problem with universities is they operate so slowly. You know, in university, they say, you're fired. I want you out of here by 2017. a person is brought up in the Derrida, Foucault generation in the humanities, and he's going to teach, and he's going to be there for 40 years.
Death is the only cure.
Yeah, death is the cure. And then you have to hope that they haven't infected the next generation.
country.
Well, that's the question. Has it become self-perpetuating now, or is it a generation that we will eventually see the back of?
I've always wondered, how do these people fill the hour? That is to say, after you've said Shakespeare is gay and a running dog of capitalism, you've still got, I still have 54 minutes. You know, what else?
That's what patrimony is for. Then you go into imperialism and patrimony.
So you'd think it would exhaust itself, but one hopes that it would.
Well, you know, when I was doing that book, I talked to a lot of academics, and I remember speaking to one academic who had, he was a chairman of a literature department at a liberal arts school. And he had come up in the 70s as a champion of the working man and the
usual.
Yes, all that.
The usual suspects.
And eventually became the chair of his department. First he was head of the hiring committee, then chair of the department. So he's getting ready to retire now. And I spent a wistful afternoon with him in his office. And the sun was going down. I really should have written this one up. The sun was going down, and he finally said to me that how the department had changed. And he said, you know, you can now get a degree in literature from my school and never read Shakespeare. And when he said it, it was almost as, I think I screwed up my whole career, because he saw it as the fruit of what he had set in motion, and he was reluctant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's fine for him because he's about to retire. It's the kids who are going to come after that I worry about.
This reminds me, by the way, of the only funny thing Lionel Trilling has ever said or recorded. In the story of This Time of That Place, a young sort of hardy comes up to the teacher in the story and says, you know, I was myself an English major. And the professor says, oh, really, in what regiment?
The resort to alternative institutions at the ancient and prestigious universities, the liberal arts may have become corrupted, but look at the smaller institutions, many of them quite of recent foundation, St. John's, a great books program, St. John's with two campuses in Santa Fe and Annapolis, Hillsdale in southern Michigan, half a dozen or more quite new Catholic universities, St. Thomas Aquinas here in California, Christendom in Virginia, Thomas More in New... By the way, the full name of this splendid little college in New Hampshire is Thomas More College of the Liberal Arts. Mm-hmm. So you wait a few decades, and the reform that these small new institutions are beginning will have taken effect, or they're just flickering lights as the darkness descends. What do you make of it? You're the one with the sun setting.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I have to say, though, I've had...
No, it's not an answer that's allowed, permissible.
The eight reasons for the Renaissance. I'll just say my little experience with Hillsdale College. I was there and taught a class for a couple of weeks and was just astonished at the quality of the students and the range of curiosity and the earnestness with which they wanted to acquire skills and understanding. And it turned out that a good half of them were homeschooled and had sort of their parents had consciously kept them away from the taint of public or general reformed education for their entire lives. And, you know, and then they pop up at Hillsdale College, and they're fascinating, brilliant people.
Joe. I would say, as you say this, it occurs to me that think the courage it takes. You have a son, a daughter, and he or she's been accepted Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and this child says to you, "I want to go to Hillsdale." Mm. What do you say to the kid?
Go.
Do you?
I think so.
You may. I think you. You are a better man than I. I would be very nervous about that decision. I would be, because I would say to, what I would be thinking is, you know, I'm closing a lot of doors.
Well, you'd have a discussion, right?
That's right.
Prestige matters. It is part of the way the world works.
Prestige, social connection, and empty as it is. Mm. But there it is.
The high-tech solution. Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute, quote, "The traditional association of the liberal arts and four-year colleges was already becoming an anachronism before the rise of the World Wide Web, and it is now a crumbling fossil," close quote. The internet is changing everything. And soon enough, students who want to study the liberal arts will be able to do so cheaply and miles away from Harvard or Yale, because all they will need is a computer with an internet connection for lectures and texts. And even we now have Skype is the beginning of the ability to have face-to-face conversations, even classroom conversations. You buy this?
I don't, not a bit. I have the feeling that much of what goes on the internet's about information and not about knowledge or education. I'm told that people who've taught online courses find it, as teachers, very trying and dreary. You know, you just handle hundreds of emails every day from students, and there isn't that feeling of something's going on. You know, when I taught these sort of soft courses in Henry James and Willa Cather and Joseph Conrad, all I was really aiming for was to convince these rather small classes of 30 or so students how serious and important this is.
That's it.
And yeah, and that I was myself, without saying it, a kind of serious person with an interesting point of view about the world, and which is what I remember about my teachers, that I was impressed by their general culture. In my case, many of them were Europeans, mm-hmm. who were, you know, Hitler's gift to America, who had come here and hoping that they would want, as I wanted, entree to this sort of higher culture, this interesting way of looking at the world. But no answers, but just this interesting way of...
Andy, the internet won't cut it?
Well, I think that this sort of utopianism that a lot of internet mavens have is infecting the talk about the liberal arts now. But just to second what Joe said, is so much of a real education is social in the sense, and I don't mean everybody going on Facebook. I mean social in the sense that you're surrounded by people that maybe you want to impress, or people who can tell you things in the off moments as you're walking out of class, or, you know, in the unlikely event that your professor has any office hours, you can go see him, and that sort of thing. So there's a communal aspect to it that I suppose is lost. But again, I feel churlish complaining about it, because I seem to be complaining about everything about it. And it does offer some kind of way out, perhaps.
Last question. Listen for a moment, and it will take a moment, but I think it's worth it. Listen for a moment to John Sloan Dickey, president of Dartmouth College, speaking in 1954. The liberal arts present choices, ranging from the largest philosophic issues of wisdom and wrongdoing through the dilemmas of statecraft, the hypotheses and many wrong ways of science, to the most delicate variants of taste and style and expression and all art forms. Could any field other than the liberal arts yield as broad and as significant an introduction to life's comparisons and choices? Could any other provide a more vital classroom experience for the development of men who are free, not primarily because of birth, but because they have learned to use their birthright to choose a way of life? Close quote.
Marvelous stuff. And I would only add one thing to it. Mr. Dickey would not get the job today as president of Dartmouth.
That was my question. What must we do? Will we ever live to hear an American educator speak, first of all, just in that register of high seriousness, let alone what he was saying, the register with which he said it, mm-hmm. and to speak so seriously. Will we ever hear it? What must we do to live long enough to hear the president of a major American institution speak in such a way? Andy?
Well, you know, I actually had lunch with Jacques Barzin once. I think he was a friend of yours. And I was...
I had lunch with him too, Buster. he lived to be 104. He had a lot of lunches.
He had a lot of lunches,
He ate lightly. He had a salad.
Is that like a humble brag, or what is it that he just said? Anyway,
Jacques Barzin, the provost of Columbia, the author of many books, man who at the age of 93 published a magnum opus on Western civilization. Right. You had lunch with Jacques Barzin.
So my pal Jackie and I were having a hot dog. And...
you disagreed about World War II, didn't you?
Yeah, he was all for it. But anyway, I remember it going on in my usual gloomy way, much as we have here. And he was absolutely refused to give in to despair or gloom or any of those other sins. And his attitude was, and I think that this is partly because he had a mind that was so formed by the entire life of Western civilization was not Stoicism, but sort of, you know, it is sometimes given to people to live in an age like this where certain things are crumbling. It's not clear what new things are going to come, whether there will be any comparison to the new things as opposed to the old things. And you just hold on to what you know to be true. And that's really all you can do. But it's no reason to, you know, stick your head in the oven.
Andrew Ferguson, author of Crazy You, and Joseph Epstein, author of Essays in Biography. You've both written more. And you're now working on a book on the humanities in American higher education.
I'm trying to work on
it. Well, that's... Joseph Epstein, Andrew Ferguson, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
For The Wall Street Journal and Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.